Hello and welcome to the penultimate TCR Daily Podcast, coming to you from a hotel very, very close to the TCR finish line in Burgas, Bulgaria. We can almost smell the riders from here. You smell that, Ross?
Smell it.
Tonight, we've assembled a big podcast crew to try and compensate for the fact that Rob's still away. Don't worry, he'll be back tomorrow for the final pod. But joining me tonight to tie up all the loose ends as the finishers party draws ever closer, I've got Becky Waters. So welcome back, Becky.
Thanks again, Tom.
And we've also got Karen Tosti returning after her bikepacking getaway. Hey, Karen, how was your trip?
It was lovely. I feel equal parts revitalized and tired out. But yeah, North Wales cycling is very wonderful. But it's good to be back.
Yeah, it was good to have you back. And becoming somewhat of a pod regular, we're very happy about that. It's everyone's favourite race reporter and now official race therapist as well, Ross Brannigan.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me back.
We'll explain that. Do you want to explain that now? Or do you want to explain
we can talk
later?
Yeah,
okay, we'll come on to that later. So what we're doing now to start these pods, as all the riders gradually trickle into the finish line, is talk about who has been finishing since we last spoke. So I'll just hand it over to you guys to talk about some of the notable finishers. And I guess we'll start off with Matt Falconer, the ice cream connoisseur.
He is indeed. I saw on his Instagram today that he's created a story highlight just for ice creams on TCR. And he's racked up a good few.
Do we know what is the total number of ice creams consumed?
Well, I was about to mention this because really eerily, we have had 55 finishers in total so far. Matt Falconer is doing his fifth TCR. He's capped number 5 and he finished off with 54 ice creams, but then had his 55th just after having his Brevi card stamped.
So, oh, we'll include that. That counts.
I think that counts, yeah. So I don't know if this is all by design.
Maybe it was his target.
The big 5.
That's the headline, isn't it? The ice cream count, which we should mention before, how long it took him to finish, which is...
inconsequential, really.
It does, yeah. No one really cares about that. But he seems in good spirits, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's already cutting about, having a few beers, looking like he's enjoying himself. So, yeah, big well done to Matt.
Yeah, well done, Matt. And then the big story that we were talking about last time was this battle between the two pairs. So we left that on a bit of a cliffhanger because they hadn't finished on the last pod. So how did that play out, guys?
I was really delighted to come back from having been a bit out the loop for a couple of days to find out it had been such a battle. I was quietly hoping that the gates might get caught, but it's crazy. I mean, someone who was following it more closely in live, please tell me more what happened.
Yeah, I can probably provide some detail. I spoke to both the pairs today, asking them kind of how it went down. And the basic story is that Rich and Sam, the father and son team, they became aware of Christopher and Jonathan, who are a New Zealand and US pairing. They became aware of them chasing them down in about Serbia. And they kind of were like, oh, these guys are kind of catching us on a little bit. And then they followed one of Rob's sagacious pieces of advice, which is sleep less. So Chris and Jonathan basically just didn't sleep for much of the latter half of the race. If my information is correct, because it came from the two of them, they only had a 20-minute power nap between CP4 and the finish, or something ridiculous like that. Mm. Whereas the gates stopped at the ferry port on the Danube for about 3 hours. So just given the fact that the ferries kind of put everything into a neutralized zone, Chris and John managed to catch up. And then really interestingly, they did take separate ferries, which meant they ended up going on two different roads, but they did end up coming together at a junction, sort of like halfway through Bulgaria. And then you would have thought there would have been like some real exciting tussle and sprint finish for the line, but it was actually a bit more dull than that. Christopher and Jonathan passed the gates whilst the gates had pulled off into a petrol station. And they had a little roll down to the finish, and they didn't see each other at all. So it was like, oh no. So it just shows you that watching these dots, you're like able to imprint some kind of meaning onto it. And you're like, whoa, they're sprinting for the finish. But yeah, it was a little bit more mundane than that. But
so were the pairs oblivious as to how close they were then?
I think they were aware, but they never saw each other on the road, apart from John and Christopher sort of seeing some blinking red lights in front of them a little bit and then seeing them peel away. And then they passed a petrol station and they saw the distinctive pink and black jersey of the gates in a petrol station. So that was the only sight they had.
A sight that they'd been hoping to see for several days, probably dreaming of.
How close to the finish then did the gates stop? Because that sounds like it was pretty close.
I would have been about 80 to 100 kilometers out. Yeah, reasonably close. Interestingly, I found out from Christian Jakobek today that Adam Bialik stopped with about 60k to go, and stopped to do a little bit of a refuel, which was quite interesting.
But what time was he arriving in Burgas? Because if you know you're going to arrive in the early hours, and you're not going to get food.
Yes.
In a weird way, you could be resupplying for your arrival.
After the finish.
Yeah.
It's also still relatively far to ride. It's still quite far to ride, though, if you're an empty.
True. True. Mm-hmm. We forget 60 kilometres. It sounds so insignificant because it's like 1.5% of the total distance. But it's still...
Still a good
ride.
Saturday morning bike ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Chris and John were in very good spirits. They really hoped to do well. This is kind of their first race they've completed as a pair. They tried out TPR, Trans-Pyrenees, but just from mechanical issues meant that they had to drop out. So this was really good for them, and they were super chuffed. Rich and Sam were also similarly not too bothered about how they placed. They were just really pleased to have got it done. But I think Sam has kind of said that that will be the last ultra distance event he'll do for a little while. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of people say that on the finish line, though, to be fair.
He seemed quite convinced, but yeah, maybe we'll see what he says in about 6 months' time.
Absolutely. And in the end, did they arrive? It was only 11 minutes or so between them.
Yeah. Yeah, 9 minutes, I think, apart. So it was pretty exciting finale.
Yeah.
I don't know how Richard managed to lose two places while Sam lost four.
I was thinking that. Yeah. I was thinking that. But they are just behind each other in the overall positions, aren't they? So Christopher and Jonathan will be joint 43rd and Richard and Sam will be joint 45th. So the results will tell enough of a story, hopefully.
Okay, well, let's get on to this official winner announcement then. Transcontinental have released an official winner announcement today, which confirms Christoph Strasser as the winner of Transcontinental number 8. And you might ask why it's necessary to do that, because he's evidently won the race. But how it works on the TCR is that all of the possible infringements and time penalties are looked at and worked out after the official end of the race has passed, and then it takes a little time to kind of process all that, so a few days after the end of the race is when all of the places are actually confirmed. So that's how it would usually work, but there was an incident that happened during the race that threw some kind of doubt over whether Christoph would indeed be able to keep his official first place, and because of that the organization decided that they needed to resolve this a bit earlier than they normally would. So the official statement, and this is a kind of slightly appended version for the sake of the podcast, but it's all the important information is in here, is on the afternoon of 1st of August 2022, it came to our attention that a possible rule infringement of Rule 2 had taken place between number 100, Christoph Strasser, and number 50, Ulrich Bartholomos, at 1:30 Eastern European summertime. Christoph and Ulrich shared a drink which cost €1. The drink was requested by Ulrich and purchased by Christoph. While in essence this is outside assistance by a fellow rider, and therefore contrary to Rule 2, it is also a human moment between two riders who wanted to recognise each other's success on the race so far. The Transcontinental Race Manual refers to such incidents as doing something cheeky, a lapse in judgment or lack of focus on the rules that results in little or no impact on the race as a whole. So now that Ulrich has presented evidence to prove he had very recently purchased a resupply and was therefore not actually in need of the €1 drink, we're satisfied that we have resolved this issue appropriately and respectfully with the riders in person to ensure a conclusion that both protects the integrity of this race for all TCR number 8 riders and the race in general for future riders. We're therefore delighted to be able to confirm Christoph as the winner of TCR number 8. Congratulations on a fantastic performance. So what do we make of that?
It's a big meaty statement to get through. And it's probably worth noting that it was obvious, but Christoph is the one who bought the drink and Ulrich is the one who accepted the drink. And in the TCR manual, both that giving and receiving of outside assistance is forbidden, but there is a clause later in the manual that says, talks about if you're doing something cheeky, which I think a €1 drink is. For me, there are two important things when looking at how to approach what a rider's done, and that's intent and payoff. And there was no, I don't believe there was any malintent here. In fact, they were looking to share a Coca-Cola. From what it sounds like on Ulrich and Christoph's Instagram, they were looking to share a drink, having not seen each other. And for the whole race, they were just going to open a tinny, have a little can together and celebrate. And then the payoff is that Ulrich got a can of Coca-Cola, having already resupplied earlier. So there doesn't seem to have been any intent for a major advantage, and nor did either rider get a major advantage over each other or anyone else in the race. And the manual also talks about, if you're unsure, think about the other riders in the race. And realistically, I can't imagine any rider having an issue with someone buying another rider a €1 drink.
Yeah, I guess the thing is as well that in terms of an advantage to be gained from this, it was clear that there was no advantage really gained. Christoph at the end still won by, you know, a massive margin. And Ulrich, in fact, even suffered and fell back through the race. So this €1 can of Coke wasn't enough to push him through to the end. Maybe not a great advertisement for Coca-Cola, but c'est la vie. So yeah, it seems that if there was to be any harsh punishment, it would have been disproportionate to the action, which I think is something that, yeah, Lost Dot have to be aware of and not be seen to be too despotic about it.
And we've kind of been right in the center of the race, and we've watched this unfold, and we knew about this as it was happening. So we've had quite a few days to kind of live with this. From your perspective as a dot watcher from the outside, seeing the statement come out, you know, from Transcontinental, what impression do you get from the outside?
So I was relieved to see this statement had come out today, because it's good to clarify actually exactly what it was that happened, because I think there was a fair bit of speculation and rumour online as well. So it's good to have clarity on what happened. And I think when you see the situation, and for, as has just, you know, Becky and Ross, you've just said, you think about how would other riders behind them in the race feel about it. I mean, it feels an inconsequential act that's just a very human thing to want to share that moment. And I think the alternative of Christoph and Ulrich being essentially disqualified from the GC for that feels like it would have been an incredibly harsh punishment, essentially, which I would imagine might turn or be very difficult for a lot of people to understand that are maybe not so close to the ins and outs of TCR rules and manual and so on. I'm sure there are others who think, you know, a rule break is a rule break and that should be it. But for me personally, I think when people have really laid themselves on the line for however many days it ended up being, 10 days, for an act that didn't give anyone an unfair advantage and only happened because they met, it sounds like if they hadn't both been there, Ulrich would have had no need to stop. He would have just carried on riding. He didn't need the refuel. So yeah, I was relieved to see that statement come out.
It has been a week almost. I think we all saw it on Christoph's Instagram first when he posted it to his stories, and it was then later deleted. But since he finished, and between now, we've all been tiptoeing around calling him the first finisher, calling everyone else the second finisher. And now we have this clarity and we all know who has won. And it should be a fairly widely agreed resolution. But it was, I thought it was quite interesting to see how much of an investigation went into it. Talking to each rider, Ulrich says he provided evidence of a resupply before they tried to buy this drink. I mean, obviously it's been taken very seriously, because ultimately what's at stake here is the reputation of Transcontinental and the reputation of two highly competitive riders. Christoph's a fully professional athlete and Ulrich is a semi-professional athlete. And this is one of Christoph's many career highlights, and it will also be Ulrich's. So it warranted further investigation. And it's the resolution I think we've all been waiting for.
Yeah, I think as well, the reason that it took so long is, well, for one thing, it's not something that you want to rush. But secondly, because of the very nature of the race and the race organisers and the fact that the first finishers are at the finish before the race organisers are, it was important for them to be able to have the discussion face to face with them. And so being there, able to talk to them, flesh it out and let them provide their account of what happened rather than spurious rumors, was far outweighed the need for a quick resolution. And so just as Tom sort of introduced it, TCR, they look at the infringements and anything that's against their names before actually making final decisions. And so then, yeah, this is kind of in keeping with that. We were really surprised, weren't we, when we first heard of this story? Because when I was at CP3, like, Christoph turned down some guy's Toblerone that he offered him. Like, it was the most funny thing I've ever seen. This, like, kind of half-drunk Montenegrin guy, like, handing Christoph a Toblerone. He was like, here, man, I don't want it. You have it. You need it for a bike race. And then Christoph was like, no, I can't take it as an unsupported event. Yeah. So this was bizarre, but now we've got the full story. It's a bit more nuanced.
Yeah, I think in terms of a good lesson that people can take away from this as well, is that in that clause that we were talking about in the race manual, there's a big emphasis on communication between the riders and the organisation. And basically it says that if you are worried that you might have done something wrong, the thing that you should do is to immediately ask the race director or whatever appropriate channel of communication it is, explain what's happened and try and work out whether it's okay or not. And in this case, that didn't really happen. Neither of the riders got in touch with Transcontinental about it. And I think Christoph's media team kind of remove the evidence of what happened, whether that was on purpose or not, or just a coincidence. But it gave the impression of not being open and honest about this incident with the organization. And that clause kind of makes it clear that the way that you deal with it, the way you talk about it, and how honest and transparent you are about what you've done actually really affects the consequences for you as a rider. And we've seen lots of examples of that on this race, haven't we, of riders doing things that are basically fine, but they're everyone's thinking about this spirit of the race and making sure that they're complying with doing it in the right way. And we've had a few examples of people asking whether things are okay or not, and normally they are.
I find it funny that some of them even use, like, I think I'm doing something cheeky.
Yeah,
and that's literally in the race manual. We had Magdalena, who I think's just going through CP4, and she asked if I think I'm doing something kind of cheeky by leaving her saddlebag at the top of a climb when she had to descend it and come back up again.
Yeah, so that's all resolved now, and I think it's a big relief for everyone, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ross, you have been talking to some of the riders today and you've spotted a bit of a theme that you thought might be an interesting talking point.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk us through it?
Yeah, so quite a few of the guys have been talking about this, and it seems quite strange that at the end of a 4,200 kilometer race, a lot of them have been citing that the last 2 days were the best that they've ever felt. And I just thought this was quite interesting. Maybe it's an adrenaline rush. Maybe it's a little bit of endorphins. And I was just wondering if you guys had had any experience of this last minute surge of energy that gets you across the line. And I guess, like, maybe why that is and what you experienced whenever you felt that.
I'd say the last probably 24 hours of my ride were highly stressful because I'd worked out my average speed so far, how far I had left to go, and the cutoff time for the close. And I was up against it the whole way. So I wouldn't necessarily say I felt a burst of energy. It was probably just a 24-hour rush of adrenaline to make it to Brest on time. And eventually came in with 13 minutes to spare. But they were quite a stressful 24 hours.
So do you think that was the a necessity, an adrenaline burst? And that's possibly what others, the people that you've been speaking to, Ross, maybe that's what's driving them as well? Or is it actually you have the sense that they're just getting into the swing of things and they're now kind of, you know, they finish their warm up now and they're just ready to keep going?
Maybe. And I think some of the guys are, you know, we're talking about the guys in top 50. So they're maybe just getting warmed up and they're ready for a sprint finish. But it was just quite interesting how, I guess maybe after that adaptation you've gone through over a whole week and your body's just like accumulating this volume and suddenly it's like, oh, I can just deal with this now. Maybe there's something physiological in it. I don't know. I'm not an expert.
So I would say it's the entire opposite of my experience in both Transatlantic Way and Transcontinental. I'm not sure I've ever ridden so slowly in my life as the last 100 kilometres of both of those races. And I think it's partly because I had ridden myself into the ground or kind of sleep deprived myself into the ground. But also, I guess, relating to the point about Adam stopping 60 kilometres from the end, 100 kilometres, it feels such a little distance when you've just ridden 3,900 kilometres or probably more like 4,200 kilometres in the case of these guys. But it's still really far and you still need to remember to eat. And I think by that point in the race, I was so focused on getting to the end. I forgot to eat. And I remember a very lonely search for an ice cream in Greece in the middle day, midday heat. I think that's also it. You're really pushing yourself to just get to the finish line that you maybe for the rest of the race you've been trying to not ride in the peak hours of the day and rest then to avoid the heat, but because it's the last day you just think, oh, I'll just push on through. Maybe I just made poor decisions towards the end of my races, but I was absolutely flagging. I had no final burst of energy. Maybe at the end of a 400k Audax I've had that kind of absolute tape, like, yeah, you feel like you've got a tailwind for the last 50k or something and you're just powering along as if you've, you know, only just got warmed up, exactly that. But ultra distance, no, definitely not me. But good on everyone who can finish saying that.
Looking at the dots, we know that no one has scratched since the fourth control point down to the finish. So geographically, it probably feels like the final run-in because it is almost southeast. And aside from the Danube, or the crossing of the Danube, there aren't any major hurdles, no major mountain ranges. So perhaps it's just a moment of elation that they're pretty confident they're going to get there. The worst is done. And it's just a relief and, yeah, this elation that their body's then able to express and to keep riding a bit faster.
There is also a geographical element to it as well, because that last bit is largely flat as far as we can tell. So if you've been constantly punished by mountains for basically the whole of the race, and then suddenly you've got a couple of days of riding on flat, you probably are going to feel a bit of a relief from that. I was thinking that we might see more of this happening as we get into the mid-pack, because if you look at the guys that are contesting right up at the front of the race, they've really been hammering themselves for the whole sort of 10 or 12 days or whatever it is that they've taken. And they're really pushing themselves to the absolute limit. So it's very unlikely that they're going to get to the end and start to feel better. You know what I mean? Because they're kind of the way they're managing their effort is really, well, they're not really managing their effort. They're just kind of giving it 100%. If you look at someone like Ulrich, he's just been on the edge since sort of like the first day, basically. Whereas people that are, their main goal is to try and finish the race and get to the finish, they probably will have been riding within themselves. And then at the same time, they've had like almost 2 weeks of constant training, like you say. So they've been getting better throughout the whole thing. They've been getting fitter and stronger, and they've been kind of keeping some back because they don't quite know if they're going to be able to finish or not. So it would make sense that if you're riding like that, you get to the end and you surprise yourself with how much energy you've got and how strong you are suddenly. So I can, we'll probably see more of that.
I think that's a great point, Tom, and I'm also wondering if there's one other thing, again kind of related to the geography, in that Danube river crossing gives people kind of a really clear intermediary checkpoint essentially that they know they need to aim towards. So there's not that much variation in routes that you're seeing people taking between coming off the parkour and getting to the Danube, and then again from the Danube to the finish. There's just kind of a few routes that everyone's taking. So I wonder if there's also that kind of just like a very clear trajectory that you need to follow, and there's doesn't seem to be so much scope for people kind of going off on tangents and maybe having routing issues. I don't know. That's speculation from looking at the map, but I'm kind of, I'm just wondering if actually psychologically from control point four, it's not like you've got to go all the way to the finish. You've actually got that Danube crossing that you need to be aiming for. So it's kind of broken it up for them.
It creates that pinch point, almost like a mandatory pinch point. And you can see that however many riders ahead of you have also done the same route, and you're by no means the first.
It might have enforced some sleep for people as well that they wouldn't have normally got, which would help them coming into the finish.
Yes.
Or enforce some time trialing.
Or both. We'll just have a quick update on the Lanterne Rouge GC race to control point four that is happening, and the control point four cutoff is in about 5 hours time, isn't it? It's 4 a.m. Which is about 5 hours from now. So we'll have a look at this live now to see how they're getting on, but I had a quick look earlier on in the day to see whether there are any riders that would be really racing to try and make that cutoff. And basically, the cutoff was the border, to be honest, I thought. So any riders still in Serbia who hadn't crossed over into Romania yet, I don't think they had any chance of making that cutoff by 4 a.m. But the riders that had made it across the border last, which are Peter Boynton and Alexei Kataev from Russia, they are right in the danger zone. So when I looked at cap number 225, it took him 9 hours from where they were. And when I worked it out, it would require Pete and Alexei about kind of between 8.5 and 9 hours to get to the control. So it's going to be really tight.
And that's and to they've get got the
Transalpina to do as well. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. No mean feat. Yeah, sorry, it's definitely worth mentioning that they've got to get over a huge mountain pass in the middle of the night.
Huge mountain pass. Yeah.
So I was just Google Mapsing it earlier, and it looked like it's about 80 kilometers to the control point from Targu Carbonesti, and I reckon they're about 20 kilometers past that now, so they've probably still got kind of 50 or 60 kilometers to go. A good chunk of that is going to be pretty slow up the Transalpina. So I agree, it feels like they're in the danger zone, but not out of the question that they'll make it.
And behind them, there are a couple of riders that look to be maybe 100 or 200k back, and they're really out of the running for meeting that cutoff. And perhaps they know that. That's why there's such a big gap behind behind the two riders who are making it, who are cutting it fine. But even if they don't hit the control point in time for the cutoff, they still get a finish. They're just out of GC.
Yeah, it's important that we make that distinction, because it can feel like it's all or nothing. But yeah, you still very much get a finish.
Yeah, and I think the only other thing to mention is that number 32, Sergei Shulubin, who was the last person into control point 3 to close. So Sergei is in that group of people that are just on the border between Serbia and Romania, so definitely are not going to make it to the control point in time before it closes. But I guess just to mention, I think he's the second rider on the road that's on a fixed gear bike. So yeah, pretty impressive to have got that far, to be honest, anyway.
Okay, so today's scratch report, there's actually quite a few. And the first one, as we were talking about yesterday, is our good friend Eric Veneman, who had effectively scratched, but we weren't 100% sure whether he was definitely going to pull the plug, but he's kind of followed through with that and called an end to his race. And I think the plan is still that he's going to come over to Burgas. So hopefully we'll see him maybe at the party if he makes it in time. And then we've got cap number 224, Frank Scholler, who scratched just west of control point 4. And then basically everyone else is scratched in Serbia, really. It's kind of
a graveyard.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of people there. So cap 6, Andrea de Grutola, 163, Bella Kuzla, 147, Carl Bjorklund, 51, Calvin O'Keefe, 15, Anka Drescher, who actually scratched in Italy, and 246, Rafael Martinez Gonzalez. And yeah, apologies if we've repeated any of those or missed anyone out. And then one pair as well scratched today, 263, Ron Ten Boer and Robert Hajima, just south of Serbia. In the south of Serbia. So yeah, another victim of
another Serbian scratch. Yeah. Another Serbian scratch.
Yeah, the Serbian scratch. That's
sounds a bit nasty, doesn't it? I would go to a chemist if you had the Serbian scratch.
Right, Karen, as you're back, it's only right that you take us through on a little tour of the social media scene, as I know you're such an avid social media follower.
All over it. Can't get enough. So today I've pulled out a couple of interesting posts about scratching, really. So there's a post on Instagram from Sophie Gatto. So I think she actually scratched a few days ago now. But she's posted on Instagram just this most idyllic scene of a little hut and her bike in the mountains. I assume it's in Montenegro, in Domitor. And she just says, this is where I officially scratched. And yeah, it's not a bad view to finish. And I would agree, it's an absolutely beautiful view. And in my head, she's now kind of setting up shop there and she's going to live out her days in this amazing landscape in a little hut. But it did get me thinking, you know, what do people do when they scratch in the middle of nowhere? I think, you know, you quite often see people scratching close to the control points because obviously it's a bit of a kind of place of safety. Once you've scratched, there are people who can help you and so on. But what do people do when they scratch in the middle of nowhere?
I think sometimes with riders, once you've got it in your head that you're going to scratch, you'll kind of do whatever it takes to get home. So for some riders, that is still a fairly long ride to either an airport or if you live on the continent, maybe a train station. But it can be a bit of a logistical nightmare getting you and your bike out of a remote area to a transport hub to then further transfer to get home.
Quite often when you scratch, it's because your bike's broken. So that rules out quite a handy form of transport for getting you onto your next stage of your journey. Yeah. It becomes a new adventure in itself, which is probably an unwelcome one that you didn't sign up to, but it's an adventure nonetheless that you're going to have to deal with. Yeah. So it hasn't happened to you guys then?
No, luckily not so far.
No, the worst that I've had is I had a mechanical going up a mountain pass. So I had to walk up the rest of that pass, camped on the top, and then I could sort of roll down the other side, but I couldn't actually pedal my bike. So I had to walk it into the closest town, and I ended up scratching in that town, and I was in Macedonia, and I had to get into Greece, and that became quite a challenge trying to find a taxi driver that would take me over the border, because there's a lot of like political issues between those two countries. So I it took me ages, and I ended up finding one guy that would do it, and he put the bike in the taxi, and then as we approached the border, he took the taxi sign off the roof, and then I had to give him like a 20 euro note, which he put inside my passport for when we went through the passport control to bribe them. and then I was on my way. So that's the kind of thing
that's fun.
Gotta smuggle yourself out of countries.
Yeah. That's the kind of thing you have to deal with. But that wasn't in the middle of nowhere. You know, where Sophie is looks like she's really far from any sort of towns or transport hubs or whatever.
It's like paradise.
Yeah. Mm. So I think you're right. I think the most likely scenario there is she's just now living there.
The next thing that was picked out on social media, it was on Instagram, was a guy called Marcel Janssen. He's been doing some sketches about the TCR, and his handle is it's Marcel, like without the vowels, so MRCL_sketches. And the one that he's put out today is about an all-terrain bike, and the front half of the bike looks like a fat tire with drop handlebars, and then there's a tiny mud guard, and how would you describe the rear tire?
Well, it's a kind of heavy duty caterpillar track.
Yeah. But it's got an arse saver under the seat, so at least you won't get muddy.
Yeah.
But he's also done some others more broadly about the TCR and what it's like to be a dot watcher is one of them. And then the other one is about saddles of the TCR. And not one of the items in the drawing is actually a saddle. They all look like torture instruments or cacti. So it's definitely worth a look.
Very good. It's great stuff. Go and check out the Instagram page. Really lovely stuff. Very funny. Great observations. And then there's another artistic social media post here
Who's... You're going to throw me under the bus and try and get the name, Tom?
Yeah, who's that? Who's that one from, Becky?
It's Nicola Zatchekowicz. Oh, God. She did say, you'll have trouble pronouncing my surname. And I was like, well, yeah, I'm British, so probably.
Zatchekowicz?
But more importantly, yeah? Zatchekowicz. I knew
it,
you'd
you
get
it,
Karen.
Fast, it makes it sound like you know what you're saying. Yeah. Nicola Zatchekowicz?
But more importantly than her name is her, I guess it's a caricature of Ulrich and Christoph at the finish. Mm-hmm. And it's really beautiful. Her Instagram handle is one drawing a day, and day has two Y's on the end and there's an underscore between each name. But she's also hashtagged Transcontinental and TCR number 8 if anyone wants to have a look. I thought it was just really cool, and I can't remember having seen this before, these like beautiful artistic pieces to have come out of the race from dot watches. Have you guys seen anything like this before?
I can't remember seeing any sort of fan art from TCR, and it is really cool to just see how much it means to people, because you know, so much time and effort has gone into this, and they're really like reflecting on a lot of the intricacies and nuances of the race, and it's just people responding to something they've really got into. It's really cool to see. Okay, all right. So let's look at one listener question then. Guys, what have we got through on the email?
So we've got a question through from Daniel Kramer, who says, being aware of rivers and lakes running dry in Europe because of the warm weather and of the fires, I was intrigued by your podcast mentioning but not elaborating on the potential impact of climate change on the race outcomes. With things bound to go worse, is climate change something you will have to take into account when organising these events? And then he also says, love the podcast. So thanks, Tanya.
Thanks. It might be a good moment to mention about the Tour Divide this year. Every year, the Tour Divide is subject to some reroute or another. Generally, it follows the Great Divide mountain bike route, but it happens on the second Friday of June, and the weather's fairly unpredictable. It starts in Canada and heads all the way down to the Mexico border. And this year, there was actually such a big reroute that the fastest rider wouldn't be eligible to take Mike Hall's record, because the route was deviated so much from the traditional route. And there were kind of freak cold storms up north with heavy snow and cold temperatures that really caught a lot of riders out, and meant that riders relied on a lot of the local search and rescue. And then further down south, there was torrential rain that caused clay roads into mud. So I think we're already seeing it. A race that typically has a few reroutes saw, I think, more than ever. And it was so defining.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's going to impact the race, and that climate change is going to impact everything and people's lives everywhere. And I guess in places further to the south of where we are in the UK, all the more so. So it feels inevitable that the race is going to need to be alert and adapting to these kinds of things in the way that we all are going to have to be adapting to these things. But I don't know if it's a live conversation, or it's something that will just be kind of addressed as and when it came up. Because I know there were the forest fires in Czechia around Control Point 1. So I guess there was potential that the route was going to have to be changed because of that. I think Tommy said Anna had done a recce of the parkour, and it was fine.
Yeah.
But I guess it just needed the winds to have been blowing in a different direction, and maybe the route would need to, the control point and parkour would have needed to have been changed.
Yeah, I guess it's something that it would be good to ask the race director and the race coordinators about, because I don't know how much this kind of stuff has been factored into the planning. So in that instance, Anna was really reacting to something that was happening, and you know, she might have had to shut down that parkour unexpectedly, and I'm not sure if there was any kind of contingency plan based around the fact that there might be wildfires there, because nobody would have expected there to be wildfires there. I don't think that's really part of the planning, but I don't want to say that, because maybe they do plan that kind of stuff in. But that's the kind of thing that probably will come into come into consideration for planning the race in the future more and more, and coming up with alternative plans for, like, if this river's too low and the ferry doesn't work, or if you're going through a sort of very dry forested area that's prone to these fires, you know, is there a couple of different options for a parkour that might just need to be more adaptable in the future?
Yeah, I think you're right as well in saying that it's really hard to say what those changes necessarily will be and how to create contingency plans for them right now, because we don't know what the changes might be. And I guess all we do know is that extreme weather patterns will become more frequent, and extreme storms, extreme heat, extreme cold will likely become more of a factor in these races. And so how we adapt to that is going to be up to future races to decide.
So I alluded to the fact that Ross is now the transcontinental race therapist, and this is why.
Yeah, so some people might have noticed Mikel Font, Cap27, making a rather interesting route choice with regards to getting to the finish, seemingly running parallel to the final parkour. And I caught him just after he arrived at the finish and asked him a couple of questions. And he admitted that he'd made a mistake. He hadn't noticed that the parkour was where it was. I'm not entirely sure how he managed to do that, but he admitted it was an error on his part. But he was extremely philosophical about it. He spoke to me for about 20 minutes just chatting. In fact, I sort of left the conversation a couple of times before being brought back in, and I think Mikel just wanted to chat about it, and I really appreciated that. But he said that his whole point was, what is one more brevet card stamp? He was like, I have come here, I've got what I wanted, I had the journey, I had the transcendent moments, I had the experience. What is it to me to get that final brevet card stamp in the books if I'm already here, I've already finished? And we saw a similar situation-ish happen with Bruno just the other day, where he came to the finish line with problems with his bike and then had to ride back out 100 kilometers and then ride back 80 through the parkour or something like that. And so Mikel kind of walked away. He said, thanks to this guy for talking to me about it. It was really nice.
He said he'd helped him process his thoughts, which is also what Amrai said as well. So you've been doing a good job going on these riders and helping them process their experience and make sense of it and come to some good decisions, I think.
But I think that's kind of the weirdly unspoken thing that the media team does with the riders, because a lot of them are so present and in the moment that they never really stop to consider their own situation and where they are and what that means to them. And so asking probing questions that get them to stop and think does maybe help with that. I don't know if Karen or Becky, you've ever come across that and had someone ask you about your experience and it's kind of maybe allowed you to put it in perspective a bit more.
I'm not sure I had anyone shoving a microphone in my face in the immediate aftermath or even during any races. So not on that front, but I mean, generally, I think there's so much that someone experiences through that race. So I think it makes total sense that kind of being prompted into talking about things is going to help you probably even remember some of the stuff that you've done and kind of think through perhaps in a more conscious way, like kind of why you took certain decisions and being okay with that. So yeah, I can imagine it's quite a therapeutic encounter with you sometimes, Ross.
I've never had that with any media, but I have had it with other riders. And TCR, I was climbing the Galibier with Jenny Tuff, and she's so wise, you know, she's so wise. And just, yeah, shared a moment, and it was some of the things she said and it all just clicked. And so I've never had it with a media car, but sometimes sharing that experience with someone who is going through exactly what you're going through is just as valuable, different, but valuable.
That's really nice.
I have just had a bit of a gear change. I have just had a look at the dots and looked at Mikael's track, and there are two riders who seem to be further south than the general procession of dots, and that's Malte Heger and, you guessed it, Mikko Mäkipää, which means that they are they don't look to be taking the most direct route to the start of the Finnish parkour, so we could be seeing another two riders make the same mistake, intentional or not.
Heger is really dropped south, isn't he? He's really carving a line south, so
I know
where he's off to. Yeah,
is he going to Istanbul?
Yeah, has he got the wrong finish line?
Well, we were wondering if Mikael Font had sort of gotten mixed up with, I think, a 2019 parkour or something like that. But the story finishes that he's just chilling out right now. He's had a beer. He's having a think whether he wants to go off and do it. I think he might end up doing it in the morning before the heat of the day and just rolling in mid-afternoon. We'll see.
Yeah, I really respect his philosophy on this, because he's come to a very individual decision that shows a lot of self-understanding of what he wants to get out of the experience.
I agree. And what would that extra 70, 80 kilometers of riding out and back up and down the parkour really give you? It's like when people do a 99 mile ride and sometimes feel like they have to do that extra mile to reach 100, but you're really going to get the same out of it.
That last mile, that's where all the experience, all the change happens.
Yeah.
It's transcendental, that last mile.
I mean, if anyone's not doing that last mile, they're absolutely mental. So, you've got to do that. From what? totally different thing.
Yeah, from speaking to the riders who've come through the final parkour, I don't think it's the most glamorous parkour in the world. I think there's some trucks and there's a crossing and there's a bit of gravel and blah, blah, blah. So, you know. I think he took a nice route in.
Okay, right. Well, that is all we've got time for. So thanks so much, Karen, for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And thanks to Becky for coming along as well.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And thanks to resident therapist Ross.
No problem, guys. I'll send you my card.
Don't forget, you can send in any questions about the TCR for our veterans to chat about in the final episode. So you've only got one chance left. Send those into race@transcontinental.cc with pod question as the subject. Thanks for listening. Well, there's not really much point in subscribing now because it's only one left. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.